You're listening to RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we ponder the perils of the Game Master PC. We talk about the interpersonal relationships between PCs and NPCs, and PCs and PCs. And finally, we take another look at the metal miniature alternatives. Well, welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and joining me is Mark and Zach. Welcome back, Zach.
Hey, thank you. Good to be back.
Together, we're going to be your ringmasters for this episode of RPG Circus. And, well, it's been a couple of weeks. pretty boring. When we get to the news, I've had to scrape the bottom of the barrel a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Oh, I don't think it's that bad. It's not a whole lot of fires to put out, at least not that we're talking about. So, yeah.
Well, that's good, though. I mean...
Yeah, sometimes no news is good news in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about anybody scamming anyone this week or anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a positive thing in my book.
So, yeah, so let's just get to it. Let's go ahead and let's do the news. Well, let's see. First up, we have Margaret Weiss Productions. You were a little in on this one a little bit, Zach. I guess they dropped their price of their Cortex RPG system PDF to $9.99.
That's right, and that's the system used in RPGs like Serenity. They do have
and Battlestar Galactica
and BSG. That's right. Yeah. That's right. They have a lot of shows. They just announced this past week. They're also doing a Smallville RPG, which will have a slightly different version of the Cortex system in there, but I digress. It's Margaret Weiss's in-house system for her company there. So what happened is I got it in the Gamers Helping Haiti bundle, which was really cool of them to donate. And I had said, look, you know, this is a really neat system. It's very comparable in some ways to Savage Worlds and Unisystem. In several good ways, and it's a little more traditional than those in some senses. I said, but you have Savage Worlds where the PDF is $9.99. You're trying to sell this PDF for $21.99? And, you know, some people chimed in on my blog similarly with some comments, and within 4 hours we got a response from Margaret Weiss Productions saying that they were dropping the price immediately to $9.99, and that they would be taking care of anyone who had purchased it in the last 90 days. So, you know, it's nice to know that publishers listen sometimes. I was completely gobsmacked, but it was one of the cooler things that's happened on my blog recently, and I was really happy to see a company, you know, listen and, you know, actually do something. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
Know, yeah,
yeah, they went up really, really quickly in my book for that one.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing. PDFs is, I mean, I think it was the post that you were talking about. PDFs are priced really oddly. PDFs are no real rhyme or reason. You know, it's kind of.
They are, yeah.
It will be interesting to see what happens when game stores actually start publishing things as ebooks, kind of like to the Kindle or the iPad when everyone gets one. Because, you know, in both cases, they have pretty hardcore limits on what they want for their pricing. And a lot of times, the major publishers that push these, it's like it does not, they've actually pushed the ebooks to a cost where it's just barely cheaper to buy an ebook than it is to buy a regular book. And I don't understand where the costs are in that. But that's, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Interesting note on the iPad as well. Rogue Games is already talking about publishing for that.
Really?
And they're going to keep their prices. Yeah, you know, Rogue Games, the publishers of Colonial Gothic and Thousand Suns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they are looking at publishing for the iPad as well. And they're talking about keeping their prices right around the same. Now, I think they want pricing, the iPad wants pricing in that 99-cent increment, you know, 99 cents, 8.99, 9.99, whatever, which is pretty close to what Rogue Games charges now for their PDFs. They have a pretty set structure. They're one of the more affordable PDF companies. So I'm interested to see who takes the lead on that, if anyone else steps up to the plate. Should be really interesting, like you said, Jeff.
Very cool.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, the Paizo's RPG Superstar 2010 contest is over, and the winner is Matt Goodall with Cult of the Ebon Destroyers. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Ebon? Does anyone know?
I think it's Ebon.
Ebon? Okay.
I think so.
Maybe.
Anyway.
Ebon? I don't know.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know either. You know, one of my great laments is half the time when I get a supplement, they should put a pronunciation guide in there because I have no clue how to pronounce anything.
That's one of the weird things about the hobby, too, is many of us have read the same material, but for a number of years, we were pretty much insular, you know, and someone pronounces it Loth, someone pronounces it Loth. You know, there's such a discrepancy in how you pronounce things in the
Dro home. Or Drow. That's the infamous
Dro,
one.
Drow, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know why, but I've just never I had never heard it pronounced Dro until I read it in a blog. Mm-hmm. So that's that. But, you know, good news is he won, and they'll be publishing his adventure once he actually puts it together. And that will be in January of 2011. You know, I'd actually like to get him on the podcast, but I checked out his profile on over at Paizo's forums, and he's in Australia.
Oh.
So that might be a little difficult to arrange. But
we have enough trouble with Jim in Finland. No, Jim's actually no trouble, but I'm saying.
Exactly. But I'd still, you know, if there was some way to arrange it, maybe we still might swing that. So
that'd be neat.
So, Matt, if you're actually listening to our podcast and you want to figure out how to arrange to come on, we'd be more than happy to try to figure that out somehow. So
yeah, absolutely.
In other news, our friends over at Critical Hits got someone else joining their team. Chris Sims. Yeah, I guess he's a former Wizards of the Coast designer and editor.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. You know, I mean, I know most of the guys over at Critical Hits, at least. I met most of them at last Gen Con, so I say I know them. I don't know them. So I think that's pretty cool that they're actually getting some more people, heavy hitters, which kind of brings me to the point that I've always had where I think to a certain degree there's going to be blogs that are kind of going to be beginning to be more conglomerations. I'm not saying there's not going to be the individual contributors anymore, but I think the major blogs for the hobby, if you will, or the hobby of reporting about the hobby.
Well, I mean, that was one of the inspirations for this podcast was you were talking on your blog about getting some of the blogs combined together and or just starting a podcast. And I said, I'd be more than happy to join you for a podcast.
Yep, exactly. And I still think that that's the way to go. I mean, because most of us, you know, I mean, I can't write every day. Unfortunately, I'd love to. I just don't have the time. And my blog, my blog has suffered because of that. You know, last year I was writing almost 5 entries a week. Now I'm down to maybe 2.5. So
yeah,
it gets a little draining. So having a lot of people there can help sometimes because you can actually take a break and your blog doesn't suffer because there's nobody writing for it. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's where Michael is. You know, with Stargazer's World, he actually has additional people now writing for his blog.
Yes. I think that's worked out rather well for him, too. I really have enjoyed the content lately. So
yeah, it's been great.
I liked Michael's blog when it was just Michael, but I understand the need to bring more people on. You know, I've toyed with the idea myself, but I just haven't.
Yeah, and most of your readers were like, no.
that idea did not go over well with my particular readership. But that's, you know, that's okay. I'll do what I can.
Yep.
I won't do any more than I can.
Exactly. So let's go, and we have... next up is Greg Stafford. Pendragon Publications seems to have a going out of business sale. Funny thing is that it's only going out of business in the fact that he's closing up his small publishing shop. The whole Pendragon stuff is still continuing on. He just decided to let the bigger boys handle it rather than deal with doing, I guess, the self-publishing aspect of it.
That makes sense.
I'm curious how many of those supplements will continue to be published by the larger publishing companies. Is there going to be something where there's a collector item? Because if you look, it's pretty much quick print right now that he does. And he's selling 88-page publications for $40 because Pendragon has some serious fans.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder about picking one of those up, you know.
Well, but I won't lie to you. His supplements right now, when I checked today, he had like 10 left of one and 7 left of another. Mm-hmm. And after and that, he's he's officially closed.
That's right. And he's print only as well. So, you know, no cheapy PDFs to be had, at least not legally. So.
All right. And hey, you know what? Our friends from Gold, I guess they're season one DVD. It's almost ready for release. So, and it should be released shortly.
All right.
Which is exciting. Me and Zach actually had lunch with a couple of those guys, right? Breakfast.
We had breakfast at Cafe Patatou. Woo!
Awesome.
I cannot wait. That was like the best breakfast ever. Not that we didn't enjoy the company of David and everyone as well, but man, that is just killer breakfast. You can tell I'm a gamer. You can tell my stomach's in it, you know? So. But yeah, David and the entire crew are just really cool guys. I'm excited to see that, and I hope that there'll be a season two of Gold coming out soon.
Yeah, that would be cool. And finally, just because, well, I thought it was funny, the RPG Examiner tries to do a rebuttal of the Undateable book. Did you see that?
Yes.
You know, which was basically, yes, gamers are really low on the totem pole for actually having dates, and i.e., conversely, by that logic, sex.
You know, which is also mentioned World of Warcraft. At least there were equal opportunity about it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, which is funny coming from, well, all three of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Aren't we all married?
Yep.
We are. Which, again, does not necessarily equate to sex, but that takes the podcast in an entirely different direction. So,
I think it's
funny, though.
Yeah, I think it always boils down to the same thing. It's like, gaming is not something you normally tell people the first time you meet them. It's like, I don't walk into a job. It's like that whole job interview thing that happened a while back. You don't just walk up to someone and say, "Hi, I'm a gamer." Yeah, if you do that, people are going to shy away from you because they're going to think there's something mentally wrong with you.
But you can say that about many hobbies. If someone came up to me like, "Hi, I enjoy model trains." You know, great.
You know what? Speaking of model trains, I was actually on Hulu watching an old episode of The Addams Family. I think it was like the first episode. And Gomez, in the course of that TV show, you know, there's always the normals that interacted with the Addams Family. And one of them came to visit, and he was talking to Gomez, and Gomez was in the train room, and he crashed two trains. He says, "Here, you want to crash this train?" It's like, why do I want to crash a train? He says, "Why do you do that?" He says, "Well, why?" And Gomez's reply was, "Why not? You know, why would, what was it? Why would any other, why would a grown man play with trains otherwise?" Or something to that effect. Oh, why else would a grown man play with trains? That's what it was. Basically, if he couldn't blow them up, then there was no reason to play with them. So, but yeah, definitely you're right. I mean, that's any hobby. I mean, I have a couple more hobbies that are, I'm not going to say, not as far-fetched for people to grasp as gaming. But yeah, that's not the first thing you do. You don't walk up and go like, "Hi, I play, you know, Tiddlywinks on a daily basis," or, you know,
I'm a champion.
Well, you know, it's just like, you know, someone doesn't want to know that, you know, you play poker every Friday. That might turn them off. Yeah. It doesn't matter that poker's more acceptable than most forms of gaming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
I follow IndyCar. I don't go and say, "Hi, you know, I'm an IndyCar fan."
Exactly.
Most people nowadays don't exactly know what that is, but, you know, that's okay.
So, but no, I think that just about covers it for the news. You guys set?
I think so.
That's about right.
All right. Well, why don't we just step into it? And Zach, you're up first with the perils of the Game Master player character.
Yeah, this is a big one. I there are a lot of horror stories online about things that GMs or Game Masters do that are, let's just say it nicely, irritants to the group. And one of the big ones is a GMPC, or a Game Master player character, basically having your cake and eating it too. And now there are a lot of ways that this can manifest. Maybe you guys are short a player, so the GM says, hey, I'll play a guy too. You know, you guys need a cleric, I'll play a cleric. Or maybe the GM just really wants to play along in his little sandbox that he created. However it happens, the GM ends up with a player character. Now, I'm not saying that all GM PCs are a bad idea. However, they are probably... No, there's no probably about it. One of the most abused facets of game mastery that there are. And I think the reason... Well, there are a number of reasons for it, but how many times have you guys heard the horror story about, well, the GM made a PC and he made him incredibly awesome and our guys just stood around and looked while his guy, you know, did 7 ninja kicks through the band of orcs and killed all of them.
Oh, I've had similar things.
Yeah. It's a pretty common complaint.
Or
and I think... Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
I was about to say, or the other one, the one that I had was where basically the party as a whole was basically insignificant to all of his NPCs. Because his NPCs were like basically the main thrust of the story. Well, okay. That's great for if you're trying to... If you're running a story where we're supposed to be the secondary support team... And you just focus on that and the high level guy. But it's like when the high level guys have to keep bailing you out, there's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. And I think sometimes GM NPCs or non-player characters can morph or become in reality player characters. Because the GM is working them so hard in making them the star of your game or stealing the spotlight, whether he knows it or not, that the fifth time that Gandalf shows up to save your bacon... That's no longer the GM just bailing you out. That's the GM being like, isn't this character I made awesome? and you know, that happens a lot. People want to be seen as... I think ex-players have a problem letting go. I think that game masters want to be a part, not just run. And I think sometimes it's not a conscious thing, but when you are everyone else in the entire world of your setting... And you're also playing a player character, there's the potential for abuse. I don't care how good of a game master you are or how much you don't want to do it, but being in control of the reality of that world doesn't bode well for a game master's player character.
Yeah.
And very, very few times that turns out well. I'm not saying it can't, but it really is something as a game master to kind of check yourself and say, okay, am I being partial in this? Am I making my guy the center of attention?
Yeah, I think you hit it there on the head. If as a game master you have an NPC that has the spotlight way too often, then you're probably running a game master PC, not an NPC.
Yeah. And it is a big difference because as Jeff Reince of Jeff's Game Blog once said, your NPCs suck and they're all going to die. And that's how I like to try and GM. They should be challenging, but no one should be immortal. I mean, unless you're in like an Immortals campaign. And even then, I don't know. But to me, I think there's no way that you can't set up your sparkling, precious little snowflake as this infallible thing. You need to... it all feeds into the bad GM habits. I think a GM NPC or PC that's super powerful easily leads into railroading, and railroading easily leads into that, and it's a vicious circle.
And eventually, none of the players are going to want to game with the game master. Yeah.
And they'll write an angry post about it online one day, and that's how it will end up.
Or they'll just leave and form their own group. Yes.
So, well, yeah, that's true too. So.
Or, you know, we've done this. I've had a group where the game master in question couldn't get it through his head that we didn't really want to play with them, so we just stopped. We just always kept saying we were busy.
Yeah.
It's like, no, we're busy. Got something else to do.
Now, with me, actually, a lot of the games that I've run have usually had GMPCs. Back when I first started running games, my old Star Wars campaign, I played a GMPC just because I didn't know any better, because the guy who taught me how to roleplay, he used a GMPC. And usually he just operated as sort of the group's pilot, but then it would occasionally end up going out on the adventures with him. And it worked well because I would have other players take over as the GM on occasion. So it allowed me to have a character basically already there who's already with the group. And then recently in our Eberron campaign, I've been playing a sword mage and using him as a GMPC and just sort of using him as an extra body in combat. And now that we've got another player who's now taken over as the DM, it's allowed me to just have a character ready to go without having to find a way to introduce him into the campaign.
Yeah, that's actually one of the ways that I've actually seen a GMPC used, was where if people take turns actually game mastering around kind of in the group for a particular game, then usually you can kind of get away with that.
Yeah.
I think so. I think rotational GM duties is a pretty valid reason for having a GMPC. I've also used it where we've had the GM run the henchman in a D&D rule cyclopedia game.
Yeah.
And that worked out pretty well because, you know, old Snuffy, the gnome torchbearer, is probably not going to steal the show. He will probably be eaten by a gelatinous cube before he steals the show. So I think there are some ways in which it can be useful, but it's just one of, it's another thing to safeguard against as a game master, that you're not, not, you know, I've been through it as well on the other side, where another one I wanted to bring up, a little variation on it, is the best friend in the group PC, where the game master has his best buddy in the group and that player gets the extra perks and everything. But then you're getting into the group dynamic and everything, and that just, that's something that needs to be addressed in the group. But you can also have a GM's buddy PC, which can also be a problem. So,
I think that's a problem, and I think that's why you're right. If you can at all do it, rotating GM duties at some level is always important, because that's a major cause out of game master burnout. Really, is just the fact that, and I think in some ways, I think some of the GMPCs that I've seen are an attempt by the game master to prevent himself from burning out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I've done it.
I think as an inexperienced GM, you can also use it as a railroading device or a plot point. You know, the kindly old sage that shows up to, almost like Dungeon Master on the old D&D cartoon. So if you're playing Dungeon Master on the old D&D cartoon, that's probably need to re-examine what you're doing. Goes for granted.
God, you just had me had flashbacks to the 80s. Thanks.
Oh, my daughter and I have been watching the D&D cartoon online. It's awesome.
Oh, really?
She's all about it, man. So I love the fact that every time Venger tries to, not to get too far off topic, but it's like Tiamat's in the setting, you know? And it's like every time, like the only thing the kids have going for them is like, hey, let's lure Tiamat over here. Tiamat hates Venger's, just hates his guts, you know? And so even though Tiamat's, you know, a total B, you also have Venger who she can't stand. So it's like all the kids got going for them. They got like one crappy item each and that's it. So they pretty much have to invoke Tiamat, so.
Well, you know, the problem is just that the stupid wizard doesn't know how to use his item.
Yeah, man, he's pulling all sorts of crap out of that hat. And then you have, not to get too far off, but you notice, like, the kids killed freaking Loth in the second episode? If you watch it, like, Avenger sends the Queen of Spiders, which, you know, shows how powerful Avenger is, and they just, like, cut the web and she goes falling down this hole forever, implying that she perishes. I'm like, man, that was like the easiest. That's like the easiest deity kill of all time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I guess for fourth edition players, we'll find out how easy it is soon enough, because Monster Manual 3 is going to be featuring her. So.
Oh, seriously?
We'll get to see if you can just cut some webs and run a hole.
They should invite back those kids to see how it affects fourth edition. You know, get the people who played the voices. They've had Penny Arcade on there. They've had... Let's try it again. Invite Venture 2. So, I'm sorry. We went way off topic there.
Yeah, we did.
I apologize. So.
Well, that's I think that's a topic for a future episode. Dungeons and Dragons cartoon deconstruction.
Yeah, it's a powerful topic. You can tell there's powerful feelings there too. So might get a little heated.
All right. So, is there anything else we need to be talking about on the GMPC? We've kind of talked a little bit about the good. We've talked a little bit about the bad. We've talked about the buddy PC for the Game Master buddy PC. I don't know. Is there anything else we need to be talking about?
I think that's a good overview. I think it's just something to be cognizant of. It's one of those things that's not bad in and of itself, but is just so easily abused. As a Game Master, you want to make sure, because chances are the players are probably not enjoying your incredible heroics quite as much as you are.
Yeah.
But that'd be my final thought on that.
Well, you know, well, talking about then Game Master PCs and interactions with players, well, we'll go ahead and right ahead into topic two, where we want to talk about, you know, the interactions that PCs have. It's actually one of the major things that make RPGs, I think, unique in terms of gaming. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the form of interpersonal relationships that PCs have with both NPCs and, of course, PCs, other PCs.
Yeah, I've noticed recently in my games that there doesn't really seem to be too much NPC interaction with my players. My players are usually, currently, my current group is more just interested in hanging out and having a good time and rolling some dice. So we haven't had really deep plots. But in past games, I've actually ended up with some really great PC and NPC interactions where it really helped immerse. The players really felt immersed because of that. And one of the ways that I've found to do that is actually with romantic relationships with PCs and NPCs. Have you guys ever messed with that at all? I know it can be a kind of shaky subject.
Typically, no. I mean, oddly enough, I think in my youth, there really weren't a lot of guys hanging out at the game store interested in romantic relationships, which kind of reinforces the stereotype that we have from the news item.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've had it pop up a couple times, but never as a framing or defining aspect.
Really. It can really be difficult because you got two guys sitting across from the table from each other and one of them's pretending to be a girl. So that's, you know, that gets awkward. But the way that I've actually discovered that it works best is just sort of keeping the actual romantic side a little bit more in the background if you aren't comfortable going that far, and focusing more on the rest of the aspects of a relationship. And you can really pull on people's heartstrings if they basically, you make assumptions about a PC and NPC's relationship. I was playing a Star Wars game a couple years back, and it was a group of smugglers, and they were asked by the Rebellion to join them in their fight against the Empire and everything like they usually do, and they all turned them down. So it was about three or four sessions later, and one of the characters had an NPC girlfriend that was on board the ship with them, and she ended up getting killed by the Empire. And before you knew it, that guy was marching into like the Rebellion headquarters and saying, "Where do I sign?" And it actually worked really well to get the group to sort of guide the group towards where I wanted them to go. I wasn't going to railroad them, but by giving them that in, it helped them where they normally wouldn't have gone back and joined the Rebellion. And then there was another game that I played in where I was actually the PC, or I was a player, and there was the beginning of a relationship sort of forming in a we were actually playing in the village of Hamlet, and that sort of started to develop, but it never actually got anywhere. I was interested in seeing like how that would actually play out, but it never did. How do you guys handle interpersonal relationships between, like, not necessarily just romantic, but also, like, friendships and familial relationships and stuff?
Yeah, you know, that's actually an interesting question. One of the things I've actually sort of found about most gamers is, for some reason, we tend to like to play the loners in games, mm-hmm. which is weird because you're in a group of loners.
Mm-hmm.
That exactly. makes no sense.
And orphans, because blank all killed their blank. So it's yeah.
Yeah. So right there we run into an issue. I mean, this is not obviously across the board, and there are of course games where the concept of having people you relate to is important, like the hero system. One of the disadvantages has always been the dependent NPC, that weird NPC that keeps showing up, you know, that you have to protect.
The Aunt May.
The Aunt May scenario, right. Or, you know, or your boss, or maybe even the boss that hates you kind of thing. So it's interesting that, you know, there are games that have those hooks. And mm-hmm. I think in those games, those are used because there's game mechanics for it, if it makes sense. Yeah. And especially in Champions, I keep calling Heroes Champions because that's how I was always introduced to the system. You know, those, you go like, oh, they're going to show up, so you have to use them. And in that case, really, it's really mechanical. You know a little bit about the NPC, you've done a little bit of stuff, and you just have them in the adventure. And of course, the player already has that tie. So they have, they already have a buy-in to interact with that player and that NPC in some way.
Well, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, Jeff, or not, but I think that over time we have penalized players for having a family in the game. I think we've penalized them for having a family as a weakness, which is why we have so many freaking orphans whose parents were killed by raiders or elves or barbarians or dwarves or orcs or drow. Or
I think you're right. I think we have penalized people for having some sort of built-in family.
Not just in the rules, but there are a lot of game masters who will just be thinking they're being dramatic. Nothing ever good comes of the family. It's always standing over your father's body, you know. Why? You know,
I think that players would rather that they kill off their family members to begin with rather than let them eventually get around to doing it.
Well, and it's gotten so freaking predictable that it's going to happen. If you have a father who's a wizened old warrior who was part of the King's Guard or something, you know that he's going to get a dagger in the back by the second session. Or something's going to happen. And unfortunately, we don't reward the good things, like the father, you know, is there as a stabilizing influence when the son comes through the area, or they have a cousin in the court, or, you know, they have this guy they can crash with if the feds are on their back. You know,
I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think a lot of times, the only times that I've seen those issues actually pay out in some way is many times if there's game mechanics to back it up. Like, there was a system for, I forget what the name of the game was, where what you did is after you generated your character, you generated a little bit of information about your mentor. So there was always a mentor in the background. The idea of the mentor wasn't necessarily get involved in anything, but if you needed someone to ask advice to or to train you, you could always go back to your mentor and get training for a lower cost. So,
well, Mouse Guard and Burning Wheel, they introduce lots about adding in NPCs to interact with.
And that's good.
I think that the setting that you're playing in makes a pretty big impact too, because if you look at D&D, usually the characters are wandering all over the world. They don't really have the opportunity to spend a lot of time with their families. So players might just be willing to say, you know what, the player's family's dead, so I don't even have to worry about them because I'm going to be on the other side of the world. With no, you know, easy way to communicate with them. So
right, but even Marco Polo had a home to come home to.
Yeah, and then if you look at things like Mouse Guard, which is a much smaller area of land to cover, they'll, you know, eventually go back. I think that Star Wars works really well. If you want to add in a few NPCs on the ship, in that same campaign that had the guy's girlfriend, we also had. The same guy had his nephew on board, who was also an NPC. And so by throwing in a few NPCs here and there, It allowed there to be interactions with non-player characters on a much deeper level, and you can always use NPCs as good plot hooks. Not necessarily to make, you know, Robin the boy hostage and everything, right. But
right.
You know, to have them just be there as part of the plot.
You know, one thing I found, since we're on the subject of NPCs, that I think I was doing for a while, is I would have several NPCs that were definitely, I don't want to say they were my special snowflakes. They didn't hog the spotlight, but I really went into depth with them. And my players might see them for 12 seconds, and that was it. And I felt like there was this entire thing that they just weren't getting. I was making them too subtle, in a way. And so I started with the advice, and I forget, you know, I've heard it for a number of years now, but basically give your NPCs one characteristic and play it. And let the other stuff kind of develop and play. And that has saved me so much time, and it's made more memorable NPCs. You know, I had a very efficient, case in point, in a recent campaign, I had a town guard sergeant. And I had made this big, long thing for him, and I said, no, we're going to do this the other way. And I made him a by-the-book stickler. Very, almost like the sergeant in the movie Zulu, okay? If you guys have ever seen that.
Yeah.
But doing that, he kind of grew, and I was able to flesh him out as we went on without spending all that time fleshing up a guy who may or may not live past the session. So, but that hook kind of caught favor with the players, and it stuck. If it didn't, well, then, you know, they remember this, and it's not a big deal. So I really found that was helpful for me, anyway.
It's kind of the extra scenario for movies, you know. You know, all the extras actually have these huge, long backstories, but you got to give them something to do in the scene and some sort of, you know, at least one trait, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's that kind of scenario.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's why people remember the fat rebel pilot from Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
If he just Porkins. Was blown up by the Death Star. Yeah, Porkins, man. Whose blog has Porkins as my co-pilot? Because that's about the funniest I've ever seen in my entire life. And I can't remember who has it.
Jack Porkins.
I can't think of who it is. But, I mean, that dude had one characteristic. He was a little Porkins. And there's, like, fanfic about him. Okay, well, yeah, for being a rebel pilot, let's face it. He'd had, you know, a few too many hot dogs, whatever. But because of this one characteristic and the way the dude went out, I mean, now he's got, on the Star Wars Wikipedia, he's got this giant entry. He's been in comic books. He's been in stories. You know, people love Porkins. And
I mean, he goes out, he's leaning forward like he's reaching under his seat for, like, some, like, Twinkie that he dropped down there. So,
I've seen the picture Photoshop where he's got, like, the chicken that he's eating. That's phenomenal. Oh, man, I'm going to have to remember what blog said Porkins is my co-pilot, because that's... Hold on, I'm going to... Please continue. I'm going to... Because they need a shout-out on the show for...
Absolutely.
For just that.
So,
but yeah, so, you know, there are many things that, you know, I actually, talking about this subject, we can pull actually a lot of things from movies. I mean, not all movies, there's always characters in movies, and they don't all end up dead, and they can be very central to a story. And I think we forget that, you know, there can be tragedy, but it doesn't necessarily need to be death.
Yeah.
And so I think as game masters, we need to try to encourage people to form these interpersonal relationships. We need to, I don't want to go as far as demand, but I think it should be a give and take. If the players create these relationships, there should be some positives as well as negatives.
That's right.
Well, I'm considering in my next campaign, sort of doing a mouse guard type thing, even if it with playing D&D. Where you have to have, like, the person who mentored you, the names of your parents, who your rival is, who your best friend is, things like that. So you actually have people that can naturally be brought into the campaign.
Ooh, I like the rival idea.
Yeah.
You know, especially...
Everybody's got somebody that they don't like.
Right.
So I think it would work really well.
You know, especially if you keep running across your rival, just doing your business and he's doing his business, and you know, he just tries to cause some nuisance to you.
That's right. If you read the Belgariad series by David Eddings, Silk constantly has his rivals showing up in town and trying to break his cover, because he's always, you know, a master of disguise and things like that. They're always trying to trip him up a little bit, and I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So did you find your blog?
Oh, yes. It's What a Horrible Night to Have a Curse. I'll send you the link.
Excellent.
I don't know, for the show notes, I guess. Awesome, I don't know. Man. I know it has nothing to do with anything we talked about, but
yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Put it in the show notes, yeah.
Because it's always fun.
That's good stuff there.
I don't have anything else to really say on the subject right now. Do you guys?
No.
Good topic, though.
Is it better? Thanks.
So I think we'll go ahead and go into the last topic. And for this one, I'm going to break tradition and actually play an audio clip first.
Hello, this is Viriatha, a writer for A World of Corruption. And I was just listening to your Season 2, Episode 5 podcast for RPG Circus. And I was listening to y'all talk about alternatives to metal miniatures. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was listening is that you never talk about the digital options. And that's something that I'm seeing come out more and more. Now, that might be because I plan to use those, but I'm seeing more people talk about hooking up things like laptops to high-definition televisions and using digital alternatives, which ultimately really would make an interesting impact on that market. All right, thank you. You all have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, she hit the nail on that one. I did not talk about the digital forms or alternatives to miniatures. And kind of part of it was strictly because I have very mixed feelings about the computerization of RPGs, which is ironic because, well, I'm a computer programmer and database administrator by day. And then by night, I am Game Master Man. No, anyway, seriously, though, it is an interesting subject. And the fact of the matter is there is a lot of options. In the show notes, I'm going to include a link to a website that lists all the virtual tabletops currently available. Some of them are a little old, some of them are new. In general, they all have the same thing in common. The Game Master has one screen where he has the ability to have a map. And basically, you end up having tokens on the screen. And depending on the software, some of them, you know, the players can have laptops where they can move their pieces around, or the Game Master can move them around. And the zenith of this has kind of been that experimental gaming table that Microsoft has shown off.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think that that's where it's going to go. And I'm sure there will be a subsection of gaming that will do that. But I'm sure there's just like right now, there are people that don't use miniatures at all. There will be people that will be using metal miniatures, paper miniatures, you name it, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I do think that, you know, the virtual tabletops do have a place, especially, you know, if that's what you guys are into. If you guys are into the technology and are willing to take the good with the bad, then yes, I mean, it's fairly inexpensive. I mean, once you buy the software, if you pay for the software at all, you know, some of the software packages have no cost. Some of them are open source. Mm-hmm. And some of them have tons of images, i.e. tokens or miniatures or whatever they want to call them, that are available. I mean, we're talking like in the gigs range. Images mm-hmm. for just about everything you can possibly think of. The downside for me is just the fact that I have to pre-make the map as a game master. Which doesn't sound like a really hard thing, but sometimes it is. I find that, you know, when I have I can sketch a map on a piece of paper using an adventure, and then when I draw it out on, you know, the vinyl mat or whatever I'm using, gaming paper even, say, then yeah, I can just, you know, I can sketch it out and draw it out real quick, and it doesn't have to have, like, 10,000 levels of detail. And the problem that I've run into is that when you use some of these virtual tabletops, you kind of start going into that level of detail that you don't need.
Yeah.
I mean, have any of you guys had any experience with that?
I actually, I guess today I'm going to keep going back to that Star Wars campaign. I actually built, because we were out to sea and stuff during that campaign, and I didn't really have a vinyl mat or anything. So I did a lot of the stuff with my laptop, and I actually designed the entire interior of the ship, on the laptop so that the players could look over the map. And I must have spent hours and hours and hours adding the smallest details. There was cups of coffee sitting on different tables around that starship. So you can spend way too much time on it. And the problem is that I think you feel obligated to, because if you're just drawing out on a vinyl mat, people are like, okay, yeah, knock that out as quick as possible. But if you're going to show up with, a computer rendered battle mat, you want it to look good.
Right. No one wants to look at a few squiggly lines on a computer screen. And I think another thing is that while it does save on the metal miniature costs, and I'm guessing in the long run, in the short run, it can actually be kind of expensive. Because, even though the software is free, there's the cost of the laptop, there's this cost of networking it if all the players have laptops to use to move these things around. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I think computers and gaming are really getting in sync. You know, there's a lot more of that going on, be it PDFs, be it character sheets. I mean, I know one guy that when he plays, plays D&D 3.5, his NPC, I think he is Game Master, I think all his NPCs are on the computer, but, his PC, his entire character sheet is just on the computer. He doesn't have a printed copy.
Yeah.
He just does everything on the computer, and it's like, well, that's cool, but, my table can't support, everyone having a laptop. There would be no room for anything else.
Yeah.
So it's kind of give and take. Don't get me wrong, netbooks are smaller. The iPad obviously can change things in this regard too, just like the Kindle can with, the books that we carry. So, I mean, I do think that this is something that we're going to watch and see. And I do like the concept of these virtual tabletops. I'm just worried sometimes that, people are going to, right now we actually, for miniatures, we kind of use the best as. It's not like every miniature we get is exactly what we need for a particular person. So we use our best guess or just say, oh, I'm going to use this die. I'm going to use this nickel. I'm going to use this beer top. I've done that, Oh, I'm going to write, I've used Green Army Men, I think as I said, the last episode, depending. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think that, and I think with the electronic stuff, I think some people might spend way too much time trying to find the perfect images to use. So there is.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Go right ahead.
I was going to say, I one of the things that came to mind with this topic was there was a pretty well-read thread on N-World about the coolest gaming setup ever is the name of the thread. And it is pretty awesome game setup. But the gentleman actually uses a projector to throw up some templates to do that sort of thing. And I think depending on if you were able to find pictures of the templates you wanted and everything, that might actually be a little less labor intensive, have some dungeon tiles or whatever.
Yeah, you're right.
Project those out.
Yeah, you're right in that. And actually, I think a lot of these do that. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. It's almost like, in some ways, it's kind of like the Paizo Game Mastery game maps, the little flip maps that they have.
That's right, yeah.
Those are very useful. They look great. Sometimes they're a little confusing, I won't lie. It's always been my complaint with a lot of the modern maps is I think sometimes we've gotten to the point where they're art pieces rather than informational points of view. One of the Paizo maps that I have for one of the Second Darknesses, if you read the text, you realize that the locations are at separate elevations. But when you look at the map, you can't really make that out.
Yeah.
And there's no way to tell you. I mean, some of the locations, some of the maps don't actually match the descriptions because, it's an artistic piece now. Someone did an artistic rendering of a map. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not to say that right. you can't have some art in map. I mean, all cartography at a certain level is artistic.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, if you look at the maps for Keep on the Shadowfell and Thunder Spiral Labyrinth and Pyramid of Shadows, I'm not sure about any of the adventures past that for 4th edition, their art on their maps is gorgeous. But luckily, they keep it simple enough that you're actually able to tell exactly what's going on with them, which I think it's a careful balance, the upstrike.
All right. I think that's all I'm going to talk on this subject, because really, the virtual tabletops are important and they're out there, but you know, I'm not going to go into an in-depth review of every single virtual tabletop there is. I've used a couple. I've used one of the one that really sticks in my mind is the old school grip software by Hunter Gordon. And the major problem that had was that you could take images and then you had a way to put the superimpose the grid over it, which was great, except for the fact that if you had a scan of a map, it was almost impossible to actually line up the grids. I don't know if you ever fixed that. I doubt it. That software has been reported to be going into a fourth version for, I think, a year and a half or something like that now. You know,
there's not been much movement on that, I don't think. No.
So, but that's it for that. I think we can actually go into our comments, since that is kind of where we're at. We actually had a couple of interesting comments. This first one is actually aimed at you there, Mark. Yeah. It was a blog comment. It said, "Hey, did Mark ever run the mouse guard game during his lunch break? He mentioned he would give us an update on his blog. If there is one, please post a link. Thanks." And that was from, I'm going to mispronounce this handle, but it was Moon Min Troll?
It looks like Moomin Troll.
Okay. There
Moomin
you go.
Troll?
That works for me.
Well, I didn't. I was really looking forward to it. Everybody ended up getting their characters made. One of the guys even ordered the mouse guard sort of in-action figures that they're selling online, sort of for inspiration. And we were planning on our ship is currently in the shipyards, and we were planning on doing it as soon as we started going out on workups, because we basically held up and we're like, you know what, we'll just wait until we start on workups. We're going to be starting workups soon, and that was a few months ago, and we're still in the yards. So that's actually why we haven't. Hopefully we'll be going on workups soon, but if not, then I'm probably just going to attempt to run it during lunch break like I had originally planned. But and actually, having somebody mention that they're interested in knowing what's going on, I think I'll definitely try getting that up and running again.
All right, well, there's the answer to that. And next up, we actually had an email comment from David G. In Japan, as he puts it at the end of his email, he says, "I've been sick in bed for a few days and downloaded a bunch of your podcast. I enjoyed them a lot, so thanks for all the effort. Have you ever thought about adding a review segment? Cheers, David G. in Japan." And the answer is yes. We actually had a little short email discussion about this earlier today. The answer is yes, we'd like to do a review segment on a more regular basis, but sometimes it's not always feasible, just like we actually always would prefer to do one interview per episode. At least that's my gist. I'd love to have an interview segment, a review segment, and then just, you know, a wild card segment, if you will, every episode. However, getting all the interviews together sometimes isn't easy, and finding something to review every podcast might not always be feasible. But we can, I think we can sure try to do that. Try to have more reviews.
Sure. And definitely next episode, look forward to a review of Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition. I'm going to go ahead and review that next episode.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that then.
Yeah.
Did you take the plunge?
I mentioned it on the last episode. My brother sent me a copy
right.
of it.
That's yeah. right. Yeah, I remember. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good brother.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to giving the review. And tonight at the game store in Minnesota that my brother works at, that's owned by Fantasy Flight, the creator of Warhammer Fantasy is doing a question and answer session. And my brother's wife is taking a bunch of questions from me to him for him to answer. And I'm going to be putting this up on my blog.
That's
so
cool.
I'll have a little Q&A with him.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and close out these comments. But before I do, I will note to those that are listening that I've kind of switched up the music a little bit just to try to change things. We still have that offer out there. If you have good ideas for bumpers or stuff, let us know. Let us know what you think of the new music. Love it, hate it, don't like it. You know, we'll go with whatever people will say. So if you'd like to tell us about that or have any other comments or to have questions for us or have a suggestion for a segment, I love suggestions for segments because, well, it gives me something to think about. So if you have any of those, you can email us at info@rpgcircus.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, and you can do that by either calling us at 1-888-643-6322, or you can actually contact us via Skype and leave a voicemail that way at RPG Circus is the handle for Skype. And, of course, we do have our little chat session online, and while I'm at work, I try to log in there. So if you actually go to rpgcircus.com/chat, it'll bring up a little web-based IRC client that you can actually log into. And if I'm online, I'll go ahead and talk to you if you'd like. So any other closing comments before we leave?
No, I know we say it every week, but we really, really like voicemails. So you're always more than welcome to give us a call, and it's toll-free. So give us a call.
Yeah, I pay for that bad boy.
Yeah, so let's use it.
Exactly. So... All right. Well, I think that does it for this episode, and we'll go ahead and stow all our equipment and see you guys in a couple of weeks. The preceding podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.